This is the Daily Radio Ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Esther. Now, here's Pastor Sandy in Esther chapter 1 with today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
Well, let's turn in our Bibles to the book of Esther. Have you ever heard the term fish out of water? It's a phrase used to describe a person outside their natural habitat. Here are a few examples. A truck driver at a poetry recital. That's a fish out of water. A vegetarian at a barbecue. An anti-gun activist at a turkey shoot. Mark Richt at a Georgia Tech Booster Club meeting. These are all fish out of water. But here's another example. The Jewish community in Persia. In 535 BC, the Babylonian Empire fell to the Persians, and King Cyrus issued a decree allowing the Jews to return to Judah to rebuild their temple. Jerusalem was the city of God. Judah and Samaria were the land that God chose for his people to dwell. Judah was home. It was where the Jews belonged. But you see, few wanted to return. While in exile, many of the Jews had prospered and had rose to prominent positions. Isaiah 6 verse 13 tells us that 90% of Jewry stayed behind and remained in Persia. They became known as the diaspora, or the dispersion. The New Testament book of James, if you'll remember, is addressed to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad, or to the diaspora Jews. In a sense, these Jews were fish out of water. They belonged in Judah, but they lived in foreign lands under Gentile rulers, surrounded by a pagan culture. Sadly, many of these Jews compromised their faith in God, and yet God remained faithful to them. His providence supernaturally protected these displaced Jews, and it ensured their survival as a people. The book of Esther is a monument to providence. Providence is God's overarching intervention in the affairs of man. It's his means of accomplishing his purposes with or without man's cooperation. The word providence is a combination of two words, pro, which means before, and video, which means to see. God sees life beforehand. He sees life before it unfolds. He sees the end from the beginning, and he orchestrates circumstances to produce the desired outcome. The prevailing of God's will in all situations is what we call providence. Esther proves that God is sovereign over all things, that he really is in control. One other point, Esther and Ruth are the two books in the Bible named after women. Ruth was a Gentile married to a Jew. Esther was a Jew married to a Gentile. The book opens by introducing us to the man that Esther would marry. Verse 1. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. This was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. Persian Empire stretched from Mesopotamia all the way to North Africa. King Ahasuerus ruled over all of Persia. And this Ahasuerus is known by the secular historians by his Greek name, Xerxes. And we know a lot about him. Xerxes was famous for his wars with Greece. You see, his father Darius had died in battle against the Greeks. And Ahasuerus wanted to avenge his father's death. He mounted an army that numbered 2 million soldiers. His navy consisted of 1,200 warships. He fought the Spartans, and he launched an attack on Athens. After several initial victories, Xerxes was ultimately defeated, and he returned to Persia. John Phillips provides an unflattering summation of Xerxes' life, but it gives you a description of what kind of man he was. He was a tyrannical despot, domineering in temper, ruthless in his exercise of power, grandiose in his schemes and ambitions, derelict in his sensuality. The ancient Greek historian Herodotus called Xerxes incompetent and corrupt. Well, the story of Esther begins in the year 438 BC, which chronologically places it between Ezra chapter 6 and chapter 7, between the return of Zerubbabel to build the temple and Ezra's return to encourage the people. In those days when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the citadel, remember Susa was a royal city of the king of Persia. It was about 150 miles north of the Persian Gulf. In the third year of his reign, he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. This was probably a skull session for his generals to plot out battle strategy. King Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, is mobilizing for war. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. Warren Wiersbe makes an interesting point. Xerxes was able to display all his wealth and glory in 6 months. Whereas Ephesians chapter 2, verse 7 tells us that it will take all of eternity for God to unfold the exceeding riches of his grace in his kindness toward us in Christ Jesus. Guys, riches that can be exhausted in 180 days ain't real riches. At the end of the 180-day exhibition, King Xerxes throws a party, verse 5. And when these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days, literally a drinking feast. For all the people were present in Shushan, the citadel, from great to small, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white and blue linen curtains. White and blue were the royal colors of the Persian Empire. They were fastened with cords of fine linen and purple on silver rods and marble pillars, and the couches were of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of alabaster, turquoise, and white and black marble. Persian Empire ruled in luxurious surroundings. And they served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other, with royal wine in abundance, according to the generosity of the king. Both history and the Bible tell us that King Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, was quite the boozer. Herodias said that he made all his important decisions while he was sauced. That's probably why he ended up defeated by the Greeks. This must have been one drunk cat. This Ahasuerus. Verse 8. In accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory. For so the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. Oh my, Xerxes was into pleasure. Queen Vashti, and by the way, her name means beautiful, and indeed she was, also made a feast for the women in the royal palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he'd been drinking nonstop for 7 days. Suddenly, this state dinner turns into a drunken orgy. And he commands Mahuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abegatha, Zethar, and Carcass, 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus. And of course, you remember, eunuchs were employed as servants in Oriental courts so the king could be assured that no hanky-panky would be going on behind his back with the women of his harem. That's why he employed eunuchs. Well, he sent these eunuchs to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown, in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. Ahasuerus is drunk. And he wants to show off his good-looking woman to all of his buddies. The implication is that he wanted this beautiful Vashti to do a little X-rated hoochie-coochie, you know. Do a little belly dancing, you know, to tease the men with her beauty. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, brought by his eunuchs. Therefore, the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. Vashti's refusal was a real credit to her character. She must not only have been beautiful on the outside, she must have been very beautiful on the inside as well. Her dignity prohibited her from parading around and titillating a bunch of smashed sheiks. Vashti was a lady. She was a person, not some object. Oh, that all young ladies today had that kind of self-respect. It's also possible that Vashti was pregnant, which would have added to her humiliation. By the way, her son that she gave birth to was named Artaxerxes, the Persian ruler who cooperated with Nehemiah in the rebuilding of the walls. Well, Queen Vashti's refusal was a noble act, but that's not how Ahasuerus and his counselors saw it. We eavesdrop in on their powwow in verse 13. Then the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for this was the king's manner toward all who knew law and justice, those closest to him being Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meris, Marsena, and Memucan. The seven provinces, princes of Persian Media, who had access to the king's presence and who ranked highest in the kingdom. Notice these king's counselors, it was said of them that they understood the times. The only problem was is that they didn't understand what counts for eternity. And a lot of people that understand the times, they're culturally relevant. That they understand what connects to people. They understand where people are at, what they're into, how to relate. But sometimes we can become so relevant to our culture that we're of no use to God. It's sad, but it seems that the church today is getting this kind of counsel. We're getting counsel from people who understand the times, but do they understand eternity and what really matters to God and what really counts for His kingdom? Well, he asks, what shall we do to Queen Vashti according to law because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus brought to her by the eunuchs? And Memucan answered before the king and the princes, Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will become known to all women, so that they all will despise their husbands in their eyes when they report, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she did not come. This very day, the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials that they have heard of the behavior of the queen. Thus, there will be excessive contempt and wrath. Now, these men who were counselors of the king, they interpreted Vashti's refusal as a potential widespread uprising, a first strike for women's liberation, women's rights throughout Persia. And so they decide they need to make an example out of Queen Vashti. Verse 19, if it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him and let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes so that it will not be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. They can't take away Vashti's dignity, so they take away her crown. She's banished from the royal court. It's interesting, Vashti retained her integrity, but her stand caused her to forfeit her privileges. Guys, it's true, virtue always comes with a price tag. It's costly, but that's why it's valuable. Integrity, dignity is costly, but that's why it's valuable. It takes courage to be a person of honor and integrity, and dignity. In verse 20, Ahasuerus' counselors make an interesting comment. When the king's decree, which he will make, is proclaimed throughout all his empire, for it is great, all wives will honor their husbands, both great and small. As I mentioned, in Oriental courts, the king's top advisors were usually eunuchs. And I have no doubt that these guys were eunuchs, since they obviously know very little about women. Men, if you think you can force your wife into honoring her husband, I got some swamp land I want to sell you. A husband doesn't demand his wife's respect, he earns it. That's how you gain respect from your wife and from your family. Bully her, intimidate her, and she'll only rebel. It's been said, he is a fool who thinks by force or skill he can turn the current of a woman's will. Only love softens a wife's heart and gains her allegiance. If you want your wife to support you and trust your leadership, then love her with the sacrificial love of Jesus. Love will melt her will and earn her respect. Well, sadly, these counselors, their call for more macho manipulation pleased the king and the princes. And the king did according to the word of Memucan. Then he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province in its own script, and to every people in their own language, that each man should be master in his own house and speak in the language of his own people. Chapter 2. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. Now, between chapters 1 and 2, 4 years elapse. And they are tough years for King Ahasuerus. He goes to battle with the Greeks, and he returns home defeated. At the Battle of Marathon, the Spartans stop his troops, and they sink 200 of his ships. He returns to Shushan, battered and beaten. He looks forward to forgetting his miseries and cuddling up with his wife. And then he remembers what he did to poor Vashti. He's full of regret. He was angry at the time. He wasn't thinking. And guys, that's why it's a good idea not to drink. Because you're never thinking when you're drinking. How many people regret a decision they made under the influence? And in Persia, when a king uttered a decree, it was irrevocable. Even the king himself couldn't go back and recant an order once it had been given. You remember, this is why Xerxes' father, King Darius, had to throw Daniel in the lion's den because he couldn't revoke his own decree. You remember the story? Well, Ahasuerus can't bring Vashti back to the throne, so he decides to remarry. Then the king's servants who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan, the citadel, into the woman's quarters, under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." The thing pleased the king, and he did so. Ahasuerus holds a beauty contest to replace Queen Vashti. He sends out his servants on a fox hunt. They comb the countryside in search of beautiful babes. The idea here is to create this huge harem. Then the king can sample the girls and he can pick the one he likes best. Hey, this is an ancient version of The Bachelor. Verse 5 introduces a key character to the story. In Shushan, the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. He was a descendant of Israel's first king, King Saul. Mordecai's great-grandfather, Kish, had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah. That's her Hebrew name, Hadassah. That is Esther, his uncle's daughter. For she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. The older man, Mordecai, and the younger girl, Esther, were cousins. And of course, Esther's friends, her Hebrew friends, called her Hadassah. That was her given name. It means myrtle. I'll bet you didn't know Esther was a southern girl. Just call her Myrtle. Remember, many of the Jews, when they came to Babylon, they received Babylonian names. You remember this? Daniel's three friends all received Babylonian names. Hanani, Azariah, Mishael also became known as Shadrach, Meshach, and to bed we go. No. That's what Ahasuerus, though, does next. That's what he does with this harem full of honeys. To bed we go. Verse 8. So it was when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women, the Jewish historian Josephus said that he gathered 400 girls, were gathered at Shushan, the citadel, under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace, into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor. So he readily gave beauty preparations to her, besides her allowance. It was something about Esther that quickly won the favor of the harem supervisor. And he gave her extra products, special treatment, extra allotments of Mary Kay. Hadassah got double the Estée Lauder and Clinique. And then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. Esther got special treatment. But notice the detail in verse 10. Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. You see, below her beautiful skin, Jewish blood ran through her veins. An anti-Semitic feeling was running high in Persia at the time. Well, I love verse 11. Every father of a daughter can relate. Every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. Fathers of little girls have a protective instinct. How many times have I paced, waiting until she got home, back and forth, back and forth. Mordecai was pacing, wanting to know what had happened to her. Well, each young woman's turn came to go into King Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months preparation, according to the regulation for the women. For thus were the days of their preparation apportioned, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying women. Each woman got 6 months of oil of Olay and 6 months of Chanel No. 5. Thus prepared, each young woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the women's quarters to the king's palace. She was given whatever she desired for her night with the king. Fresh grapes to feed the king, T-bone steak, pizza, the CD Love Songs from the 70s, scented candles. You name it, she got it. She got all the romantic gear she needed. And in the evening, she went. And in the morning, she returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of Shashgaz. What a name. The king's eunuch who kept the concubines. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. Each girl had one shot to make an impression. All the girls remained in the king's company, in his harem. They were his concubines, but only one was made his queen. By the way, single men present here tonight, let me make sure you know that just because Ahasuerus, his method of getting a wife is in the Bible, that doesn't mean that it's biblical. You understand that, don't you? Jacob worked 14 years for a wife. Boaz bought a piece of property and he got a wife as part of the deal. David won a wife by clipping off the foreskins of 200 of his father-in-law's foes. There are a lot of ways to get a wife that are in the Bible, but that doesn't make them biblical.
You've been listening to Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams, here at Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy spoke to us from the book of Esther today. Esther's life did not go exactly as planned. She was the definition of a fish out of water for so many years until she aligned with God's purpose for her life. From that day forward, she led a purpose-driven and meaningful testimony for God. Her example of following God's will for her life led others to become living witnesses. and had a tremendous impact on faith as we know it today. You may not be completely sure of God's will for your life. There will be times you feel led clearly, and then all of a sudden you realize the target is moved. Have you aligned with God's purpose for your life? If you'd like to hear more messages like this one, head over to sandyadams.org. Once again, that's sandyadams.org. While you're there, check out Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain under the About tab. If you're in the Atlanta area, why not come visit us? We have services at 9:15 and 11:15 a.m. There's more information and directions at sandyadams.org. Well, that's about all we have time for today, but we look forward to our time together again very soon. There's so much more to share with you as Pastor Sandy teaches again from the Word of God on the next edition of Sandy Adams Radio.